today. Bereaved relatives say NHS England's 111 service got it wrong at the start of this pandemic. But will things be different this time round? Earlier in this pandemic, during the spring, was a terrifying time, especially for those who watched their loved ones fall sick with this mysterious virus and then go on to die. It was, understandably, a nightmare period for the NHS as it grappled with how to cope with COVID-19 before fully understanding how to treat it or who was most at risk. The Guardian's David Conn has spent months talking to bereaved relatives about that difficult time. During his conversations, a concern about one service seems to have come up again and again: NHS England's 111 helpline. And so, spurred on by one grieving family member in particular, he began to investigate and discovered answers about who ran the service and how that might surprise you. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus: did the NHS make mistakes with its 111 service? And if so, have lessons been learned for the second wave?
This was something that was actually raised by the bereaved families group, who are people whose relatives died from COVID-19, a lot of them in those early awful weeks when it was spreading exponentially.
The Guardian's David Conn has been investigating NHS England's 111 service, the phone line that people with COVID symptoms have been directed to since the start of this pandemic. It was decided that it would be the first port of call for patients at a time that ministers were trying to prevent the disease from spreading and hospitals from being overwhelmed.
And as their group has grown, they've found that time and again, the family members are saying that the 111 call, which is everybody's first port of call if you think you're suffering from coronavirus, did not direct them to medical help and told them to stay at home, and these people subsequently died. And it's become quite a major part of their feeling that things went seriously wrong.
Were you able to understand how widespread of an issue it was?
Well, amongst the group, they've got 1,800 members, and they're saying that it comes up with a fifth of them, which is, you know, a very high proportion.
When David investigated further, he found relatives were repeatedly pointing to a few key problems. Firstly, the huge rise in demand for the service.
The NHS does publish figures, and those figures for March, they had a huge increase in the number of calls in the previous year, more than a doubling to nearly 3 million calls.
3 million calls. That meant it began to become increasingly difficult to get through to a 111 operator. I remember stories of people waiting an hour or more.
And the NHS themselves say that 38.7%, so nearly 40% of the calls were abandoned because people had waited longer than 30 seconds.
To put that in context, that was up from just 2.4% in March 2019. But the problems weren't simply around abandoned calls. They were about the advice given out to people when they did get through.
And one of the people who has pursued this issue of 111 is Lena Vincent, whose partner, Patrick McManus, died from the virus in April. She wants to get some answers and she wants to get some accountability.
Lena met Patrick when they were both on holiday 14 years ago.
He got lovely eyes. Never thought it was going to be anything more than this man that I'd met in Malta, and nice bloke, and probably that was going to be the end of it. Like a little holiday romance, I would say.
But it became more than a holiday romance.
Oh, he's brought me a lot of happiness. Patrick did. He was just a caring man.
Patrick had multiple sclerosis, but it didn't slow him down. He loved his work as a nurse and deputy ward manager. And with time, he and Lena began to build a life together. She remembers the day her world changed. She was at home, on the phone to her sister, when Patrick unexpectedly walked back into the house. "What happened?" she asked him. He told her he'd been coughing and sent home. The next day, he took a COVID test.
On a Saturday, on the 4th of April, he was diagnosed with COVID-19. The test came back positive. So he had to self-isolate for a week and see what his symptoms were going to be like over that week period.
How worried were you at that point?
The first couple of days, to be honest with you, it was like a flu reaction. Thinking if I can get through the next week or so, it should be okay. Again, we didn't know what we were expecting. We didn't know how severe this could be. So Patrick had rung the 111 service. Well, first of all, he'd phoned his doctors, who told him he had to ring the 111 service. Patrick rung the 111 service and told him his symptoms on the 7th of April. He said hot and cold. His temperature was going up a little bit. He was feeling tired. He was coughing. It was a case of, well, you've only had it a couple of days. Let's see how you go. You know, if you get any worse, ring us back. During that week, Patrick did get worse. He felt worse nearly every day. His temperature would go up and then down. One minute he's red hot. Next minute he's cold. Then he's red hot again. And this continued. But not only that, Patrick suffered with MS. Again, he'd phoned the 111 service. And that's how it continued. Three times, actually, made calls to the 111 service. And each time he told me what his symptoms were. That final call to the 111 service on the 10th of April, again, Patrick told him his symptoms. Patrick told him again that he got MS. To be told, well, you've had it for 7 days now. You can go out. And I remember hearing them saying, you've had it for 7 days. You can go out. What? So I says to Patrick, put the bloody phone down, Patrick. You don't know what you're talking about. You're only reading from a bloody script. He couldn't comprehend what they were saying to him. Anyway, he put the phone down. And on the 11th, as he came down the stairs, and as he sat on the chair at the dining table, Patrick was shaking. I've never, ever seen him like that in all the years we've been together. And I says, you've got the riggers? And he said, what? I says, you've got the riggers, Patrick. I know. I've been like that. I went like that at that time when I was admitted into hospital. And by this time, he'd got a blanket round his and he couldn't keep still. So we ended up calling a colleague from work, and I was telling her his symptoms. And she said, just ring an ambulance. Forget one more. Just ring an ambulance. Ring an ambulance. Patrick, being the person that he was, said, can I watch Britain's Got Talent first? That was the last time I saw Patrick at the house. Later that evening, he rung me to say, you know, he's in the hospital and, you know, he's just waiting for somebody to come see him. Yeah, fine enough. Speak to you later. Love you. Love you too. Those were the last words I said to Patrick. Those were the last words he said to me. Patrick was in the hospital for a week. And on the 19th of April, Patrick passed away.
Couldn't see him.
I did go see him on the 19th of April when I got a call from the hospital to say that Patrick had taken a turn. And I held his hand and I told him that I loved him. I will always well.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Lena was completely heartbroken, devastated. And there was one thing that she just could not get out of her mind. That final 111 call on April the 10th, when Patrick was told he could go out and get on with his life, just days before he died. Lena felt she had to understand what had gone wrong, and so she began asking questions.
I put a complaint in because I wasn't happy with the service that Patrick got. I wasn't happy with that call, and I asked for that call handler to be traced. That went into Contact England, where you put your complaints to.
What did you find out?
How I found out that, sorry, but the call didn't come to us.
In fact, Lena's inquiries would take her on an unexpected journey, from the NHS England website to the South Central Ambulance Service, and from there to two private companies who it turned out had taken the calls. First, Vocare, and then a huge French call centre corporation called Teleperformance, who had accepted that critical call on the 10th.
So it's just been one thing after another. So that one phone call to an NHS 111 service now has opened up. You're not the NHS, you're a private provider.
It turned out that while 111 is run by NHS England, it is operated locally by different groups, ranging from GPs and ambulance services to social enterprises and also private companies. Lena now knew where to direct her questions, but then came another frustration. Although the NHS is now clear that calls must be recorded, it turned out that this early one was not. Four different groups you were passed between to try to get answers as to why your partner had died.
Yeah.
And you were doing all of this while grieving. It must have been incredibly tough.
While I've been pursuing this in my little way, I had nobody to turn to. There was nobody out there. You weren't getting the answers. You tried. There was nowhere to go. I was just trolling through the internet and trying to find answers, and what's this way, going that way. And it was like I was bobbing in the water. Somebody chucked me in without a life jacket.
David, going into this, did you have that same impression Lena did, that 111 was entirely operated by NHS staff?
I started this with the impression that you would have, just as a citizen of the country, it's our health service. If we're poorly, we call 111. And that the NHS operates 111. And I'd thought that what normally happens is a nurse calls you back. I didn't realise that actually it's operated by call handlers in call centres. And they have a script that is worked out by the NHS on whatever medical guidance it gets. And that is supposed to direct you to the correct medical response. And in normal times, I get the impression that people feel 111 works well and that it's quite cautious and risk averse, and it will get you a doctor and get you an ambulance if it thinks, not the call handler thinks, but that the algorithm, the way the computer works, there's any question that you need medical intervention, and it's quite risk averse and it will get that. But this was a new virus and this was a huge health crisis with a huge volume of calls coming in, and that leads to the impression or the worry that it just wasn't set up well enough to deal with, you know, people who were suffering from it in the early weeks.
Do we know whether contracting out to private companies was happening to deal with this unprecedented demand during March, or is the 111 service normally contracted out?
It was contracted out more. It's not something that's public facing. The public still calls 111 and everybody feels that their call was answered by 111, but within the actual operation, they'd actually set up a whole new operation called the Coronavirus Response Service. And that appears to have been very much staffed by private companies who could get a call centre operational immediately. And my impression is, yes, that that's much more contracting out than 111 normally has in normal times.
And then, David, I know you've had a frustrating time trying to get answers, first from the Department of Health and then NHS England. They did acknowledge that private companies were used by 111, including Vocare, and other companies specifically for its coronavirus response service. Which were they?
Three very, very large logistics companies that are providing, you know, major resources to the government and also the NHS during the pandemic, which is Teleperformance, the huge French call centre company, Citel, another sort of logistics call centre company, and Serco, you know, the massive company that's doing so much, you know, involved in testing, tracing, and the 111 call handling, which Serco themselves did come back to me and said they thought they're providing a sixth of the staff for the coronavirus response service. And they said explicitly, yes, it's call handlers that are working to a script provided by the NHS.
It doesn't actually surprise me that 111 is not always staffed by people who are clinically trained. I think that's often clear when you call them. Those operators ask pretty basic questions about who you are and what your symptoms are. And then if they decide you need it, you get a call back from a clinician. But I am quite surprised that parts of it are being operated by a number of private companies. And let me ask you about why we would worry about any of this. I mean, clearly first is the transparency issue. But what about accountability? The issue for Lena seemed to be that she struggled to get answers. Okay, the NHS felt they needed to contract this stuff out to these companies, but surely the NHS is still, in the end, accountable when something goes wrong in a case like this.
Exactly, and that's the main point. So Lena has been told these were the private companies that took Patrick's calls, and the calls weren't recorded, so we can't actually investigate what advice you were given and whether it was appropriate. So that's not an answer for her. In fact, it's saying that we can't get to an answer on the main issue. What script were they working to? What was the medical input for the call handlers? What were the symptoms they were looking for? Were they aware enough of the vulnerabilities that people had? And these are the key questions: that were they adequately prepared in a medical sense, and are they prepared now?
The unanswered questions and the threat of this second wave mean that bereaved relatives are desperate for answers, not just to understand how 111 was operated, but whether the way it advised people was wrong. It seems to me that in Patrick's case, whatever script that 111 operator was following was wrong, because the advice he got was to go out when he was days away from losing his life. And that sounds like it is the sort of repeated story you heard when people called 111. They were told not to go to hospital when, in retrospect, they should have done. Is there an acknowledgement that perhaps the script that operators were following was wrong?
No, there's no acknowledgement of that. They've acknowledged that the calls weren't recorded at the beginning. But when it comes to the question of, was the medical advice given to people adequate for the virus itself and the vulnerabilities that people had? If they had diabetes, Patrick had multiple sclerosis. Was that recognised enough? I just don't feel that they've responded to that really at all. They've just told me we were working to guidance from Public Health England. So I asked Public Health England, and then they came back to me and said, well, the guidance comes from the Chief Medical Officer, and sorry to tell you, but that's the Department of Health. So I was sent back.
So you're being sent on a merry-go-round.
I was sent back to where I started.
Someone's got to be accountable.
But it does support the call of the bereaved families for an inquiry. And what they're saying is, we just want a rapid, immediate inquiry. And it's not necessarily to point fingers and have people to blame. It's genuinely to find out what happened, and they want to know why it happened, and they want to know if there are any deficiencies, and they want to know that the deficiencies are going to be put right now so that other families don't have to go through what they've been through.
Coming up, what does all of this mean for the second wave? And that's particularly relevant right now as we enter a second wave with cases rising and surely the demand for 111 spiking again. This isn't about kicking the NHS, is it? It's about understanding if lessons have been learned.
I went to the Royal College of Emergency Medicine to get some kind of idea about all of these issues from an expert medical point of view. And they gave me an interview with Adrian Boyle, who is their vice president for policy. Adrian just said,
it was an extraordinary time. We were confronted by a disease that we really didn't know very much about.
We didn't know enough about the symptoms. And we didn't know enough about the vulnerabilities. So, and actually, I think people can understand that. Then you can see how 111 probably was not equipped to deal with a challenge on this monumental scale.
As a doctor, I very much buy into what is called the duty of candor. When something's gone wrong, you need to, first of all, acknowledge that there is a problem. And it would be ridiculous to think that every decision that was made back in March on incomplete information and at times of enormous demand would be correct.
Now, I really don't want to give the impression that we or the families are suggesting that the 111 service didn't help an awful lot of people. But you would have thought that learning lessons, that really properly examining what you did would be a central part of what they do anyway.
We would be very keen for there to be a rapid review, and we've asked for this a number of times, into what we need to do to prepare for winter. A quick, rapid review, what worked, what didn't work. And I think we need to be honest with our public and say some things didn't work as well as we would like. This is what we need to do to try and fix it as we understand this better.
What you're hearing from bereaved relatives, but also from clinicians, is a desire to ensure that lessons are learned. The demands for an inquiry are pointed at Boris Johnson. Some relatives are upset that he won't meet them. So let's just focus this on the government for a minute, because everyone wants this to be better during this second wave. And to be fair to them, there have been changes, haven't there? For example, they didn't know at the start that people could look well with COVID when their blood oxygen was plummeting. But now there is guidance around instruments to detect that. They also say they are investing more into 111 for the second wave. And even if they are not being totally open about it and having a formal inquiry, as the bereaved relatives want, surely they are making improvements all the time.
Well, the key to that is in the word you just used, which is surely. And yet there's this kind of really confrontational stance which gives the impression from the government that they don't want to learn any lessons. They don't want to go there to inquire into how it was handled at the beginning.
David, Lena told me she wasn't satisfied with the answer she got.
It's something that I've had to go over and over and over in your head. If this had happened, if that lockdown had happened sooner, if the 111 service had competent people at the other end of the phone instead of sticking off a script and passing it from one company to another, from another company to another, that we've got his recording, that we haven't got his recording, that we traced the call, that we haven't traced the call, and it's just been like a bat and ball. And every time you think you've just got a piece that you can open up, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You've put your first piece down and then you'll find another piece.
Do you understand why she feels that way? And what is she doing now?
I completely understand why she feels that way. And she did get an apology from the South Central Ambulance Service that said the service that Patrick had didn't meet the standards that he or she expected. But she described that to me as a semi-apology, because it's an apology, you know, for where they got to, which is the calls weren't recorded, so they can't investigate any further. Whereas she wants accountability for the actual advice that was given, the fact that Patrick was told to stay at home, not to go to hospital. And obviously she feels like many families that when he did go, it was too late. Now, they've told her that she can go to the ombudsman, the health service ombudsman. My understanding is she might do that. She's also pushing for an inquest, which, you know, inquests are not being held into people who've died from the virus, because there's been guidance from the chief coroner essentially saying that it's a natural cause and that inquests shouldn't be used to inquire into more general policy or more general handling of the virus. But that brings the families back to the call for a public inquiry. But Lena's one bereaved person who's having to get wrapped up into all this. And, you know, it's a very, very big thing to have to take on, isn't it?
It certainly is. David Conn, thank you so much. Do read David's investigation into 111 at theguardian.com, and do also check out a previous Today in Focus episode he did with us on his investigation into the government's decision to allow mass gatherings to continue back in March. We did go to NHS England about this episode, and a spokesperson said, NHS 111, both by phone and online, has played a key role in helping the millions of people who have needed urgent care over the last 6 months. And like every health system around the world, our services have been informed by the best available evidence on COVID symptoms and risk factors as the virus has developed. As part of our extensive preparations for winter, the NHS is investing further in the 111 service, meaning even more call handlers and expert clinicians and better links into local services, including direct booking into A&E for the first time to ensure all patients who need it can see the right clinicians in the right setting. That's it for today. My thanks to Lena Vincent, Adrian Boyle, and to David Com. This episode was produced by Maitha Lee Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.